Just wanted to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of this land, this Aboriginal land, never ceded, always was and always will be. I also want to begin by thanking the Venezuela Solidarity Campaign and LASNET, Latin American Solidarity Network, both for inviting me to come along tonight. And so I do encourage people if they to contribute to help cover some of the costs of putting on today's meeting, but also were responsible for putting on together what was essentially a mini fact-finding mission that was organised, given that no matter what you posted on Facebook or social media, of course, the immediate response was, well, why don't you go to Venezuela and see what people have to say over there? Well, LASNET took the initiative and said, and Venezuela Solidarity Campaign did and said, well, right, let's go there and find out what people have to say. So that's really what I want to focus my presentation on. It will be short because I want to ensure there's time for a question and answer. My understanding is we've got the room till nine, so ensure that people have the ability to have their say, their opinions. What that means, of course, is that I won't be able to touch on, and I'll have to leave out some very important issues, some of which Joe has touched on. I may not have agreed with everything that Joe said, but at least he's introduced those as part of the discussions, part of the history of the political process, the role of the US in what's occurring at the moment, the impact of the sanctions, what's behind the economic crisis. Very important questions, but impossible for me to deal with in 15 minutes. But perhaps we'll be able to, in question and answer, deal with some of those. And of course, there are plenty of other people that have written about these kind of things. Really, what I want to use my time is to talk about what we saw there and bring back that information, because I think that's really what people are perhaps most interested in finding out. So what can I say about the 2 weeks that we spent there? I think the first thing to note was the political climate in the country. Now, it's got to be remembered that we went there in the context of where, without a doubt, what we have occurring in Venezuela today is a coup attempt. I'm happy to explain why I explained that scenario as a coup attempt in discussion if people want me to elaborate on that, but I think possibly majority, if not everyone in this room, would recognise that that is roughly what is occurring in Venezuela, independently of what we may think of the Maduro government. It was also at a time only weeks after or days after the highly tense situation on the Colombia-Venezuela border, where the world was expecting something to happen, and yet very little in the end perhaps really happened, certainly not enough in terms of what the media and the opposition were hoping for, where there's constant talk of a military on the verge of rupturing, of splitting, of a military coup occurring, where Trump administration constantly talks about military options still on the table, and me and Lutra happened to arrive literally sandwiched in between the day after Juan Guaido, the self-proclaimed interim president, had returned to the country, having left the country at the time of the stunt on the Venezuela-Colombia border, and on the day of the anniversary of Chavez's death. So one was expecting a country in turmoil. Yet when we turned up, Caracas was very quiet. And the reason was largely because it was Carnival. Carnival being one of the most important sort of holiday periods for Venezuelans, most of whom preferred to spend their time on the beach or visiting family rather than getting involved in what was occurring seemingly up above removed from what most of the ordinary people were dealing with. And this relative stability was something that we encountered no matter where we travelled, whether it was in Apure on the border region with Colombia, whether it was in Barinas, a rural state, or whether it was in Caracas, a largely calm situation. Of course, that's not to say that there wasn't protest. There were protests of both sides in support and against the government. But my reading of it, having lived there previously and seen previous protests and also speaking to people, were that neither of the protests were as big as previous ones. So they're largely much smaller protests from both sides in this current context. It was also not to say that there wasn't discontent, and I'll return to this point later on. And of course, we couldn't see and be everywhere. So for instance, you know, when we were there, there were isolated cases of looting that occurred in Maracaibo during the blackout. We weren't there, we can't report on that, but I acknowledge that happened while we were there. But as I said, in the context of a country in the midst of a coup and a possible military invasion, one could sometimes almost forget that you were in Venezuela, in a country where, at least on paper, there are two competing presidents struggling for power. And as I said, this all occurred as well within a several-day blackout, which not just affected electricity, but access to water, to food, because refrigeration was down, to communication. So a situation that perhaps in any other country would have certainly seen some level of social explosion, if not overthrow of a government, and yet none of that was what we witnessed during our time there. Combined with this relative political stability, The other very noticeable aspect of everyday life was just how hard it is for ordinary Venezuelans. It's not the way that the media portrays the very difficult situation that the Venezuelans face, because the media does not understand, or at least does not try to grapple with, the complex and contradictory nature of the situation that exists in Venezuela. But that's not to deny the very hard, very strong, extreme hardship that ordinary Venezuelans are going through. And again, I can't go this in depth, but I want to just give one example of what this means in concrete terms. As Joe mentioned, when we spoke to people, you know, the general thing is that you can't get food. There's no food in Venezuela. That was not what we witnessed. There was clearly, visibly food on the shelves that people were able to buy. The shortages were not, at least compared to a few years ago, the central problem facing ordinary Venezuelans. And in relative terms, if we look at US dollar terms, most of these products were extremely cheap. But the problem is, when you look at these prices that have been impacted on by the hyperinflation that's impacted on ordinary Venezuelans and their purchasing power over the last few years, and compare that with the minimum wage, which is roughly $4 to $6 US dollars a month, most of these goods are completely out of the grasp of ordinary people to be able to buy. As one of the National Assembly deputies that we spoke to explained, even a relatively middle-waged person earns a wage that, on paper, can afford one egg a day. That's what they're earning to be able to get by. So obviously that's a level of extreme hardship that ordinary people are having to go through. And it's almost impossible to imagine how is it that people are able to get through that. There are other issues we could talk about as well. The issue of transport. One thing that is very noticeable as someone who's lived in Caracas and having returned is the huge decrease in traffic. Now, part of that, of course, has a very small part of it has to do with immigration out of the country. That obviously has had an impact on traffic, but that doesn't explain it all. The largest part is explaining, as people explained to us, was they can't get parts for their cars. And even for the buses and stuff, they can't get parts. So whilst above ground, it seems very quiet compared to a few years ago, underground, where you've got the free metro train system all day, it's just packed out as people are having to use the metro to get through. Basic services are another contradictory situation where, of course, the media is focused on the blackouts, which, of course, have had a very drastic impact on people's lives, particularly during those days. But missing from a lot of the discourse about the basic services is the fact that Venezuela has some of the highest levels of connectivity, for instance, of households to electricity, also has the cheapest prices of basic services. So these are the contradictory and complex nature of everyday life for Venezuelans today, trying to deal with the current crisis. And all of it leads to a somewhat surreal situation because, as I've said, you've got, on the one hand, this deep economic crisis that's dramatically affecting the life of everyone, but obviously impacting on the poor the most. Secondly, you've got, at least if you turn on the TV screens or open up a newspaper outside of Venezuela, supposedly this mass struggle for democracy, whose visible head is Juan Guaido, but which is really nothing, not much more than a US-led coup attempt, and which has unprecedented international support, but little visibility with inside the country, very little constant mobilisation. Certainly, again, as I mentioned, compared to recent protests, for instance, like the ones in 2017, where we also almost saw daily sustained mobilisations roughly from April to about July, so 4 months of almost daily mobilisations. None of that is evident, neither when we were there nor on any of the time since January 23. And a population largely getting on with life as difficult as it is. So how do you explain this very complex and contradictory political situation, economic situation in Venezuela? Well, I think the US, the opposition, the media can't really explain it because they refuse to accept some certain evident realities of what is occurring in Venezuela. Every day they're predicting the fall of the Maduro government, and yet every day passes and Maduro is still there. And none of the times do these same journalists ask the question, well, why is he still there? Many of it just simply explain it by, it's simply a question of repression and it's a dictatorship. That explains everything. But of course, if we put aside the fact that there have been many dictatorships around the world where there have been mass protests and have been succeeded in being able to overthrow them, and we put aside the history of the Venezuelan people who still remember things like the Caracazo, where in 3 days, 3,000 of them were slaughtered in a mass uprising against poverty and neoliberalism. And that real sense of struggle still lives within the Venezuelan people. So these are not a people unaccustomed to coming out to protest or to face repression. What the reality is that there is none of the violence that, for instance, we saw in 2017 in the current protests on either side. The media continues to operate, and one can turn on almost any radio or TV station and see debates. Well, debates, they're not really debates, they're just panels of people agreeing on how the coup should occur, what sort of military intervention should happen in Venezuela, why, once the opposition is in power, the left should be banned, you know, the kind of things that no dictatorship would ever allow to happen. And of course, you've got the Colombian military organising on the border together with opposition activists to try to bring in so-called humanitarian aid into Venezuela, violating national sovereignty. And most significantly, you've got someone running around the country calling himself president and calling on the military to overthrow the other non-president and able to do that, something that's not very usual for a dictatorship. So I think that explanation just doesn't really cut it. And I think I would add to that that this narrative, which is largely built on the Venezuelan people as hopeless victims of the repression and dictatorship, really is one that's pushed for an international audience. And that is that the idea that the only way this can be solved is by foreign intervention. That there is no force within Venezuela, if we were to accept the logic that this was a dictatorship, that can actually deal with the situation. Only outside international support can do that. Of course, what this does is it demobilises the opposition's base within its own country, because it's basically saying, well, we can't do anything here, other people need to do it for us. And more importantly, it completely turns off anyone who doesn't want anything to do with foreign intervention, doesn't want anything to do with Donald Trump, and who may not support Maduro, but knows that US intervention inside the country is a much worse scenario. How then do we begin to explain the situation? Firstly, it must begin by recognising and acknowledging some of the important gains that have been made over the last two decades as a result of the Chavez and Maduro government, many of which have obviously also been rolled back in the last few years as a result of these economic crises, but a number of which continue to linger on and explain an ongoing sympathy, at least within a section of the Venezuelan population. Whether that be the fact that between 2 to 3 million homes have been built for ordinary Venezuelan people, whether it be that local doctors continue to exist and provide services, even though medicine shortages is a very real and life-threatening issue for many people, whether it be that the cost of access to basic services is the lowest in the region, whether it be the fact that, as I mentioned before, you have free metro transport to deal with some of the problem. Combine this with some of the more recent government initiatives, such as, for instance, the one that Joe mentioned, which are referred to as the CLAPs, the local committees for production and distribution of food, that have allowed people to have access to cheaper food, much cheaper food than what I referred to earlier in terms of the prices that people would encounter in the market, and social bonuses that the government regularly deposits into people's account. These have helped to alleviate some of the problem of the crisis. Hasn't resolved it, but certainly alleviated some of it. A second part of recognising what is going on in Venezuela or the political situation today has to begin with a recognition of the ongoing importance of community organising, whether that be through the CLAPs, the distribution of these food boxes, which is the latest initiative, but I think they're a limited initiative. They're a limited initiative, largely a party-orientated, controlled by the government and the governing party, the United Socialist Party of Venezuela, and we can discuss that more in discussion, but I thought I'd mention that. But for me, what's more important is really the aspects of grassroots petitionary democracy that so much inspired and infused people about the revolutionary process and that continue to exist today, that being things like the communes and the communal councils. We visited a number of experiences of where communities are collectively organising to produce food, to network amongst each other, to exchange goods between communes or creating production chains without intermediaries as ways of overcoming the crisis. In some cases, they're able to do this with the help of local councils. We were able to experience that, for instance, in Municipio Páez in Apure, where they've had a very interesting experience of where they've actually gone to the community and said, look, you know we're in a situation of crisis. We know we're in a situation of crisis. How can we begin to do this? And through collectively discussing with people, they've been able to, for instance, apply a tax, a voluntary tax on basic services on the basis of saying, well, look, you know this is too cheap, that we cannot afford to maintain this, but if you help to apply a basic minimal voluntary tax on some of these services, we'll use that for our participatory budget, where then the community decides where that money goes to. Their experience has been, by doing that, 80% of residents have understood that that's the only way they can get out of this crisis, for collectively contributing and discussing and debating their problems. And within the first 2 months of this year, have raised a larger budget than the entire budget handed down by the national government for the whole of this year. So you can only imagine that will only increase throughout the year. But that's been done through participatory democracy, not by imposing it from above or by simply increasing prices without any kind of discussion with the community. It's one that's been done in consultation and with the people agreeing to it. That's just one example. I could give you many contrary examples of where local mayors are not interested in that kind of democracy as well. These networks of communal councils, communes, social organisations that predate Chavez, but that were strengthened under the Chavez government and continue to exist under the Maduro government, are also important networks for the flow of information as well, and help to explain why in the poor neighbourhoods, even when you have blackouts and lack of any telecommunications, information is still able to infiltrate into these communities to let people know this is what's going on. This is what's happening with the electricity sector. Let's keep calm. Let's work out how we can resolve people's everyday problems. So I think those two are important to must be recognised, but are largely ignored in much of the media discourse and the opposition discourse. I think there are two other factors as well that need to be acknowledged as well, and that are less positive than those two. The third thing that needs to be recognised is a huge cultural shift that has occurred in ordinary Venezuelans in their consumption patterns as a result of this crisis. Of course, the easy one to talk about is how under the boom period of Chavez, we saw Venezuelans were basically able to buy almost whatever they wanted, any trademark brands, the kind of things that were always exclusive, not even thought about being able to be purchased by the popular sectors of the country. I remember last time when I lived in Venezuela, it was quite common for people to have two free mobile phones. There's two free telecommunications companies. It's cheaper to ring within each one, and so for each telecommunication company, someone had a different phone and a different phone line. This time, you found very few people with more than one phone, and even those phones were generally broken. But that's the sort of impressionistic one. What other people told us about was the changes, for instance, even in the sort of dietary patterns, a need to look for other food sources, particularly when the shortages were occurring, and to eat non-traditional food sources in order to be able to get through this day. So this is part of what people have done to be able to accustom and deal with the current crisis. And I think the fourth one, which is also a negative point that I'd point out, is the forms of survival that have flourished that are basically revolve around illegal economic activity. Whether that be through the resale of products, for instance, the cheap products provided by the government that are then brought into the black market to be resold in order to get access to money, whether it be the resale of other goods, whether it be the complete loss of almost sovereignty really in the border region, where you have massive contraband, where you have roughly about 30,000 people each day crossing the border, where buying the cheapest oil in the world, filling up their car, driving it over, selling it for $1 a litre, making two months' wages purely through that, buying products in Colombia, bringing them back over to then resell, and entire cities, transport lines basically functioning to allow this contraband to occur as another safety valve for dealing with the crisis. That loss of sovereignty goes beyond just the contraband, even to the use of currency, where, for instance, in the border regions, it was very common where people would prefer to have dollars or Colombian pesos rather than the bolivar, because the bolivar each day losing value as a result of the hyperinflation, whereas the Colombian peso, because of the amount of trade being done over the border, you served more purpose for people in those areas. And we even encountered that in Barinas, which was some 5 to 7 hours away from the border, where people were happy to accept Colombian pesos to buy stuff rather than the local currency. This, of course, then combines with corruption the growth of corruption as people who have access to resources in the state or officials in the state use that access in order to be able to overcome the crisis. And the fifth or another negative impact as well, which is the one that's been mentioned quite a lot in the media, is, of course, the immigration out of the country. An immigration wave that began firstly largely as a source of being able to bring remittances back into the country, to bring dollars back into the country, as I mentioned before. Prices are very cheap in dollars, so anyone with access to dollars obviously has another safety valve for dealing with the crisis, but many today just deciding to leave the country altogether. And of course, we can debate the exact numbers, but there's no doubt that there has been a big immigration out of the country. four points that I've mentioned, but I think the fifth and the most important, and the one that the media refused to accept, the opposition refused to accept, and really explains why Maduro continues to remain in power today, my viewpoint, at least from what I was able to gather there, is that the recognition of the ongoing endurance of Chavismo. By Chavismo, I don't just mean the government, although the government is part of it, but rather as a political movement of the poor, those who exploded onto the political scene in the 1980s and 1990s for uprisings such as the Caracazo, which took political form under Hugo Chavez, who many identified as being from the people, of the people, for the people, a movement rooted in the popular sectors, in the barrios and in the countryside, made up of activists involved in various forms of social organisations, social movements, political parties, and that penetrates deep into the military and the militias. Again, an aspect that people refuse to accept or ignore at their own peril, and are therefore unable to understand why the Venezuelan military continues to remain so solidly together, despite the intense international pressure it's under. A political movement that is deeply anti-imperialist and a very politicised movement. A movement aware of its long and short history that understands Venezuela, and you could see this in any plaza that you went to talk to people, obviously generally poorer people, people who identify with Chavismo. Venezuela's role in the struggle for independence, not just in liberating Venezuela, but numerous other countries in the region. Venezuela and the populist people's role in uprisings like the Caracazo against neoliberalism, and obviously more aware of its more recent history under Chavez as well. A movement aware of Venezuela's role in world politics, the role that Venezuela's natural resources play. It was amazing the amount of people that would just list you absolutely every single natural resource they have, starting with oil, but then going down for uranium, coltan, diamonds, gold, where the mines were, how much they could be sold at the international market. These were the kind of things that Chavez would regularly talk about in his Alo Presidente, and it's something that today is ingrained in people's understanding of what is occurring in the country today. They understand that at least some people are interested in getting their hands on these massive resources that Venezuela has. And when I say some people, I don't just mean the US as well. People also acknowledge that countries like Russia and China also have their interest in Venezuela as well. And also acknowledge that whilst they may be willing to stand up to the US, that support perhaps will only go to a certain limit, because that interest is there for economic reasons and not for deeper political reasons. And the Venezuelans understand that. And they can only rely on themselves if they are able to get out of this problem. A movement that has reshaped politics and how the poor view themselves and their place in politics in Venezuela. A movement that has basically overturned the old political order, inserted for the first time poor people into the political discourse, and having now become part of that political discourse, do not want to go back into obscurity. And that's what they fear the most of what the opposition want to do were they to get back into power. A movement that is, as always, critical, self-critical, and internally has a variety of positions. What many refer to as the class struggle within Chavismo, or the struggle against bureaucracy and corruption. You know, again, things that we could expand on in discussion, but that are worth pointing out. And that have a variety of viewpoints towards Maduro and his government, including those that oppose Maduro and want to see Maduro gone but still identify as Chavista, a minority, but that exists, those that loyally support Maduro and see Maduro as the spearhead of the process, and those that perhaps fall somewhere in between that feel like, well, for today we need to defend Maduro because of the attacks that we're facing under imperialism, but once we deal with this most immediate situation, the economic crisis, then perhaps there will have to be a reckoning with at least some of those in the government to ask the question of why weren't you dealing with this crisis earlier. A movement that still maintains at least 6 to 7 million people who support it, and that regularly in the polls shows about 30% of support. We can debate that. Some polls may put that a bit lower, nothing. I've never seen anything lower than 20%, and I've seen polls up to 35%. But let's say a third of the country, roughly, a quarter to a third, that solidly identify and have a clear project of what they support. A movement that no doubt has lost broader support that it's been able to mobilise at election times over the last periods, particularly under the heydays of Chavez, and that has seen growing discontent expressed in its own areas of mass support, in particular in the poor neighbourhoods in Caracas. And this is one thing that we saw, or at least we were able to talk with, about the protests that occurred in January prior to Juan Guaido calling himself the interim president of the country. Some of the largest protests that have occurred in what are traditionally Chavista areas, and that largely were explained by the fact that people feel look, you know, I'm putting it here crudely, but this is word for word kind of what some of the people I was able to speak with explained. Look, we voted for your constituent assembly. We voted for your local mayors. We voted for your governor. We voted for you to be president. This economic crisis is still going on. Why aren't you dealing with these problems? These are people that feel that these very urgent problems need to be dealt with and that the government is not dealing with them. And so we saw in early January some very large mobilisations, as I said, in areas, firstly, that definitely cannot be called opposition areas, and secondly, were not protests organised by or in any way identified with the opposition. And you can get the picture of, or the explanation of how that is the case, or the proof of that, where these protests dissipated as soon as Juan Guaido came onto the political sphere, because they did not want to be associated with what they saw as clearly a manoeuvre by the opposition in trying to take power in the country. Because in these sectors, as I mentioned, Chavismo remained strong, even if opposition or discontent may be growing, and that sentiment of anti-imperialism and wanting to resolve problems by themselves remains a key part of what ordinary people in the poor sectors identify with. More than Maduro, more than oil, more than anything else, I think this is the real target of the opposition and Trump. And it's also why, despite Chavismo having lost some of its support, the growing discontent that I mentioned, the protests, the opposition just cannot get traction, or at the very least cannot get the kind of traction it would need in the popular sectors were it to be able to remove Maduro from power. Why can't it do it? Because the opposition basically cannot hide its class contempt for these popular sectors. And it sees, you see this constantly come out in its discourse. And I'll give you just a couple of examples. Every time an opposition figure says, we want to go back to when life was better before Chavez, you can rest assured that 80 to 90% of poor people go, I remember what that was like, and that was not better than even what we have now. That kind of discourse that pretends to wipe out 20 years of gains that ordinary people have made, the kind of stories that everyone will tell you about, how for the first time my kid was able to go for university, how finally my mum was able to go back to school and finish high school. These things were never possible before Chavez. And when people say we want to go back to that so-called better time, for the majority of people, they recognise what is behind that discourse. When you have, for instance, Juan Guaido's key spokesperson a couple of days ago in an interview with BBC, and this, you know, interview with BBC, but it's a constant discourse that comes out, saying that we have been fighting for a long time against the usurpation of power. Now, they use the excuse that Maduro has usurped power, but Guaido's spokesperson really explained what they meant. He said their 20-year usurpation of power. For them, all of the government of Chavez was illegitimate because this was a break with the traditional political class that should always rule and must always rule Venezuela. So when poor people hear this, when Chavistas hear this, even if they hate Maduro, they recognise that what this opposition wants is to go back to that old time where poor people don't exist and marginalised and pushed to the side. So this discourse, combined with constant calls for foreign intervention for Trump to come and save them, gets absolutely zero traction amongst the popular sectors. What does this mean then for solidarity? I finish this. Sorry, I'm almost certain I've gone over time. I think obviously it's a recognition there's a confrontation of two blocks today in Venezuela. There's an opposition versus Chavismo. There's no real existing third or independent force, even if that doesn't mean that there aren't left oppositional voices that do exist and have raised their criticisms. There's a recognition of the huge debate and differences within Chavismo. And given this, I don't see any reason why we cannot here as well express those differences and have those debates and criticise the Maduro government. This is a constant question that comes out about what we can and can't do in the solidarity movement. Although I think it's always important to put it in the context of what is occurring in Venezuela. It's important, I think, to let these voices be heard, the voices that are being silenced in the media by the opposition and even occasionally by the government. Venezuelans want to resolve the problems themselves. That means our priority has to be to end the sanctions, to end the coup, to make sure there's no war and no foreign intervention in Venezuela. This is key not just to fighting the right that think that by strangling the country's economy that the people in Chavismo will submit and give up, but it's also crucial to helping those that are also fighting against sections of the government who want to use the crisis for their own means or to dampen popular protest over very legitimate demands. We need to make sure here in the solidarity movement that those are the voices that are being heard, the ones that are vital to ensure that the situation in Venezuela is resolved in the most progressive way possible, and make sure that those voices are heard in time before it's too late. Thank you.